All right. If I can have your attention, we'll go ahead and get back on track with the session this morning. I have the distinct pleasure this morning of introducing Rachel Cook. And this is the inaugural Sergey Wilde Early Career Achievement Award. So this is a new thing for forest, range, and wildland soils. So I wanted to take a moment and recognize that opportunity, but also to introduce our speaker. So Rachel is an assistant professor of silviculture and forest soils at NC State, she just settled into that position within the last couple months. Is that right? April 1st. Co-director of the Forest Productivity Cooperative. And her return to Raleigh is a bit of a homecoming of sorts. She did her graduate work in carbon change and eucalyptus plantations while she was a student at NC State. And in the intervening years, she spent some time at BASF and then also as an assistant professor of soil fertility at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Just to let you know, even though, you know, she's a shining star, it's not all work and no play. In her free time, she enjoys training horses and playing the ukulele, although she was very clear that those two things are not concurrent activities in her time. So, anyway, it's my pleasure to introduce Rachel Cook to you this morning. So take it away. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for having me. This is a real honor. I tried to have a little bit of fun putting this together, and hopefully this can lighten the mood a little bit. It's been a somber morning. I went to the astropedology session earlier today, which was really interesting, and it was a packed session. And I'm not sure if everybody was there because they were interested in Martian soils, or they really wanted to see Jim Bell, or they were assessing their immigration options. A little bit about my background. So thank you for the introduction. So that's the farm I grew up on in the background in Southern Illinois. I did my undergrad in biology and sort of had a circuitous route to get to forestry. So I came to North Carolina State for a master's in natural resources and did phytoremediation. We planted about 3,000 trees to clean up a underground contaminated site. Shifted into my PhD to work with Jose Stape and Lee Allen in the Forest Productivity Cooperative to learn more about soil carbon dynamics, and I wanted to do international work in Brazil. Like Brian said, I've worked at BASF for about 6 months and then got an offer to go to Southern Illinois University, which is about 30 miles from where I grew up. So that's one of the reasons I went back. But then I was lured back to North Carolina State once Stape left, and I had the privilege to get to come back. So I feel like I always have to sort of justify why I'm in forestry when I go to forestry meetings, particularly at the company meetings. You can guess maybe why. I grew up on a farm. Both of my families come from farms, sort of central Kentucky area. We still own two farms, and I do a lot of farm management in my free time, too. So we still have some of this property. Both my parents grew up in farming families, and then my dad's family were tobacco farmers and worked at the sawmill as well. So that's kind of my history. So when I went to Southern Illinois, I took sort of a left-hand turn out of forestry and went into ag, and a bunch of my crew is here in the back presenting a lot of their work. So I had a lot of fun in Southern Illinois, and they let me drive tractors and play with anhydrous, and I learned a lot about corn and agriculture and sort of the way things are done a little bit differently in ag. So this was a really great experience. I worked in nutrition and fertility. I did a lot of nitrogen management, worked with enhanced efficiency fertilizers. And so it was a really great experience to be there. And so then I had this incredible opportunity to come work in the Forest Productivity Cooperative. So Tom Fox is here, my co-director at Virginia Tech. We also have a co-director in University of Concepcion in Chile, Rafael Rubler. The names are on the bottom. And then we just recently brought on Otavio Campo as our new lead scientist, who will probably eventually become a co-director. And he does a lot of process-based modeling, so he's a great addition to our team. So we have incredible staff and people with the Productivity Cooperative. And if you're not familiar with the Forest Productivity Cooperative, it started in 1969 with the question of, do trees respond to fertilizer? And it turns out, as Tom likes to say, yes, they are plants too. And it's sort of developed into a large, more than just fertilization, but a lot of issues dealing with productivity. I've been to a lot of these wild lectures, and one of the things I notice particular to the Forest Soils group is it's a very contemplative group. And I think we kind of have to be because you have to wait so long to see any results. So you have some time, you got to kind of think about things. And you got to think real far ahead of time because, you know, thinking about the stuff that I'm going to be planting, you know, in these first couple of years, we're not going to harvest until maybe after I retire, you know. So you have to be patient with these things. So I really appreciate sort of the collective mentality of this group, and I always enjoy the lecture series. So it's a nice legacy. So thinking about sort of reflections and projections, you know, I feel really fortunate to have known a lot of these guys that have these really distinguished careers. I got to meet Chuck Davey when I was a master's student. And then Dan Binkley has been a great mentor of mine throughout the years. And, you know, it's a little bit intimidating to be thinking about, from these guys' perspectives, gosh, what is my career going to be like? You know, hopefully I can live up to this. So thinking about, you know, as a kid, what am I going to be when I grow up, and how am I going to make a contribution? And you know, thinking, like, am I going to make any sort of contribution that means something to people? You know, and I never really expected that I'd end up on the cover of a magazine, and particularly not the Mid-America Farmer Grower. It's actually, I think, better than Vogue, you know, because they have better information about rice. But from here, you know, sort of what is going to be my legacy in the future? So I tried to do a little pontificating about, you know, where we are and where we're going and you know, what can we as early career members do to, I don't know, sort of move the science forward. And one of the things I was thinking about, how many millennials do we have in the audience? A few. You're not a millennial. So I'm the oldest of the millennial generation. And as Barry Goldfarb likes to call me, a unique snowflake, which I take as a compliment. You know, a lot of us grew up reading books about 50 ways to save the planet. I remember I had this book when I was growing up, and I was like, oh, how am I going to save the planet? And, you know, I'm sure probably a lot of you know Daniel Quinn. So I think the sort of transition from Rachel Carson, the environmental movements, to Daniel Quinn. I know my senior year in high school, everybody read Ishmael, and everybody had this sort of notion of how do we forward the issues with sustainability, and how do we, you know, improve our management and our practices. So that's something that I think has driven a lot of people in my generation, because we see climate change coming, and we wonder what can we do to make the world a better place. You know, we're all afraid of sea level rise, and this is, you know, the sort of image growing up and thinking about what I wanted to do with myself was, gosh, what can we do, you know, to combat climate change? You know, but there's also going to be some winners and some losers, so we also see that we might see some forest productivity rise, so how do we work with some of these changes? And growing up in the Anthropocene or Anthropocene, however you pronounce it, means that we don't work in any pristine environments anymore. Right. Everything we deal with is a managed environment or an influenced environment in one way or another. And thinking about how do we manage soils and try to mitigate some of the negative consequences to make the world a better place and better for the next generation. So these are, you know, some of what I think our generation has dealt with coming up through the ranks. I'd say so there's some additional trials and tribulations as an early career scientist. So I think we have, at least this is what I'm told, we have often higher expectations for tenure for publishing and grants personship. As an advisor, I think particularly, I don't know if this is really true, but I think a lot of times women tend to be sort of the go-to counselors for a lot of people as advisors. We're expected to be involved in all these departmental things. I think I get like 100 emails a day in terms of listservs from all the colleges and all these things going on all the time that we're supposed to be participating in. And then we're supposed to have a web presence. So you got to have a website, and you got to, you know, answer a billion emails, and you're supposed to be tweeting and Facebooking and then managing your, you know, social media presence and all this. And everybody says, don't even look at ratemyprof.com or whatever that one is. Just don't even think about it. So we have all these sort of additional expectations on top of the old expectations. For the co-op, there's, you know, co-op travel, trip reports, and all these other things that have sort of mounted over time. And then We also have just more information to learn because you guys, a lot of you guys that have been around for a while, have been producing a whole lot of information over the years. So I could probably spend the next 5 years just reading papers, you know, to get caught. I'm writing papers on some of the data that's available. These are all the sites that the co-op has studies or has had studies. So it's taken me 6 months just to get up to code on what projects we have in the ground. so there's sort of a buildup of information over time. So it sort of takes longer and longer to get accustomed to what all we already know. And then for the co-op in particular, you know, we have a balance of duties between managing the co-op and managing our members, but then also managing the requirements of the department. So it's a real balancing act trying to keep everybody at least somewhat happy. And then have time to play the ukulele while you're at it. It's really hard to fit that in. But on the positive side, we have incredible opportunities as early career scientists. So I went to the Walsh lecture last night, and Bill Round was talking about getting all his cards in order to go put them through the punch machine and how long it took to do that, you know. And so... We don't have to do that anymore. And we've inherited, you know, I've inherited this amazing old library from the co-op that has, you know, books, has one of Wilde's books from like 1941 that's like typed on one side, and books from the early 40s that, you know, are about silviculture, and they don't even have a chapter on fertilization because they didn't know anything about it really back then. So it's really cool to look back through some of this old stuff. And I say old guys with all the love in my heart, because having some of the guys like Lee Allen is still around, having Tom Fox as a co-director that have been around and know what's been going on. He's not actually, I mean, I didn't mean it that way. all I'm trying to say is that, I'm going to pay for that later. All I'm trying to say is there's a lot of institutional knowledge around that it's really great to have really great to have everybody that, and it's so supportive. You know, also we have Google Scholar. We have so much at our fingertips. You know, the next generation never had to go to a library and look through a card catalog. And then the computing technology, the stuff like Jump where you can just drag and drop and look at your stats, you know, any way around. We have a tremendous availability to look at our data in ways that was never this easy with some of these graph builders and better computing. So a lot of this, and you know, with GIS, a lot of this lets us work from an atomic to a landscape level. So we have a lot of ability to really do some interesting and some interesting stuff that wasn't available before. And then just a little tag thing here: we're getting a greater diversity finally in forestry departments. So we've hired several new people at NC State, and most of them are women, and some of them are actually of color. It's amazing how things are changing. So the face of the forestry department at NC State has done a major makeover just in the last year. So that's really exciting to bring some different and new perspectives to forestry and forest soils. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things I'm sort of interested in, the notions of scale. Spatial, temporal, and application, you know, small scale up to large scale. So when I was thinking about sort of representing real soils for real people, you know, how can we build on the accomplishments of the past with all these new powerful tools to use what we learn to have better applications for real people to solve real problems, right? So how do we scale up from some, you know, very small studies to be able to make recommendations as to how to make the world a better place or grow more trees or sequester more carbon or whatever your thing is. And so how do we move from the sort of singular intensive study to larger landscape scale things? So you might have, you know, a little tiny site where you really understand the pulls and fluxes very well, but how do you build that up to what that means for many sites, right? So you have to be able to say, does this transfer to the landscape? And oftentimes, you know, it depends a lot on the region you're in. I mean, as all soil scientists, you know, things are really variable. And that's where I was really excited to get to be part of the co-op, because we have all these studies across the landscape, and we have sort of this pattern where we can look at a study on a real small scale and then try to size it up to some of these landscape-level processes. So to me, this is sort of the crux of what we are trying to do. But also in terms of scale, you know, we have the time scale of our career. So we get distracted by all the daily things going on and the 100 emails that you have to answer when you're also trying to think about, okay, am I doing everything right to get tenure? And then you're going to be thinking about, what am I planting today that I'm going to be able to harvest 25 years from now? And then what is sort of the long-term, you know, legacy of my career going to be? And what kind of, you know, what kind of legacy do you want to have? And going to these distinguished lecture series always really makes you kind of cognizant of that, and how can you sort of be a force of good in the world and still manage to, you know, get home for dinner in the meantime. And being able to stay focused on sort of what you should be doing versus what things sort of pull you in different directions because it's what funding is available, right? And so sometimes we have to sort of negotiate that fine line, and you know, a balanced teeter-totter is hardly ever stable, right? You're normally kind of up or down. So I've been interested in this for quite some time. So for my PhD, this is a little subsection, you know, so for my PhD, I looked at sort of the subatomic scale and stable carbon isotopes, looking at land use change and how pastures versus broadleafs or pines affected soil carbon. You know, going up to the stand level of a 600-acre site I worked on with some of that land use change. And then I went back to Brazil and sampled sites from 300 sites across Brazil to look up to the landscape level. So I think, you know, in science today, it's very hard to have a career focused at just one level. You kind of have to be able to extrapolate from the smallest portion up to the landscape level, maybe even the global level. But, you know, the hard part is, so how many samples do you have to take, right, to be able to say that? And last night at Bill Round's lecture, he works in Oklahoma on variable rate nitrogen and was talking about variability in soils and what is the smallest level that you actually have to look at to be able to decide how much fertilizer to apply. And they were doing 1-foot square samples, and they found as much variation in a 1-foot square sample, you know, to have a zero rate up to the full rate within, you know, 10 feet of each other. So when you're dealing with that much variability, you know, he advocated that actually we should be making fertilizer recommendations on a per plant basis. So, and they're looking at, you know, how do you put the seed in the ground affects, you know, how it responds. So we're dealing with a lot of levels of scale. And just to give you a little sum up of what I learned in my PhD was that soil carbon varies very little. As forest carbon increases, pasture carbon decreases. And so you really got to spin that in order to get a few publications out. And these people don't like to see no differences. So if anybody's interested in this sort of stuff, that stuff is all out. We actually had a really nice picture of this, too. On the cover of SSSAJ because we had this background picture of two trees in the background when everything had sort of been leveled, and then the trees sort of growing up around it. You can still sort of see the open grown trees in the middle of eucalyptus forest, so that was kind of a neat thing. So moving forward into where we're sort of at now with the co-op and also looking on multiple scales. So some of you might have seen some of Jay Raymond's work with 15N labeled fertilizers. So again, looking at sort of the subatomic scale of labeled nitrogen and being able to track nitrogen through the system and how much is left over and how much will carry over up to the landscape level scale with LIDAR work. So we have another postdoc, Matt Sumnall, who's doing a lot of really great work with LIDAR and being able to map canopies. And so, you know, we've been able, through a lot of the stuff that Jay's been doing, to get a much better understanding of how nutrients cycle in the system. And this is something that we can really scale up to the landscape level if we have a better understanding of how much understory there is. So you have more understory, more of that fertilizer in is taken up in the understory. That's the white bars there as the understory increases. So this is stuff that, you know, working, you're starting on a very small scale, but we're going to be able to size it up, you know, hopefully to landscape level scale with the use of LIDAR and some of these other tools. So that's really exciting. And getting a better idea of how crown characteristics work. So we talk about a lot about LAI. Can we get a better idea of sort of the three-dimensional level of trees, of tree canopies? And, you know, can we then maybe relate that back to soils? So there's a lot of really interesting and neat things going on that I think we'll have a lot of neat stuff to report on in the coming years. And then thinking about tools as we're moving forward, so I'm really excited. I just learned about some of these new tools available in Jump. And one of my grad students, it's here. This is one of the things we're working on because he was doing a project, is doing a project on involatilization with different soil types and what seems to be controlling involatilization of urea. And everything's collinear because total exchange capacity and organic matter and clay content, it's all interrelated. So how do you try to tease out what's actually driving certain processes and how are they related? And we have some new, better tools today to try to tease some of that stuff out. So this is some pretty exciting stuff that we're sort of just learning about. Also, in terms of scale, we can think about time. So in ag, you work on a yearly, annual basis, right? Which is kind of nice because every year you learn a little bit something more and you get that information back pretty quickly. The problem with that is the results change every year. Right? So if you're trying to get the optimum in rate, you will never be able to guess what the optimum in rate is going to be unless you can tell me what the weather is going to be like that year. Right? So you get a lot more yearly information, but it's almost too much information sometimes because you don't sort of integrate some of these things over time. We work up to eucalyptus. You're on 6-7 year rotations. At least then you can get a few rotations in your career. You get up to pine, we're talking a career's worth of time scale, and then you move to Sweden, and you're talking about multi-generational projects, right? So I find that really sort of fascinating to think about the way we do our science when we have to deal with this sort of time scale. And we are always going to be dealing with the decisions of the past, too. So a lot of our models were based on thinning response that was from trees that weren't fertilized, right? So we might be making predictions about response based on conditions that don't really exist anymore. And we're still dealing with, eroded hillsides from many, many decades ago. And some of those are still issues that we're dealing with. And then on the flip side, maybe if you inherited land that was intensive, or you acquired land that was intensively managed, but then you don't continue that intensive management, then you might actually be losing productivity over time. So the sustainability and dealing with the decisions of the past is something we always have to continue to deal with. One other thing in considering time is something called regression to the mean. So I thought I really had something here when I was doing my soil carbon work, and I said, aha, initial soil C predicts later soil C. And Dan Binkley was actually showing this to somebody that said, have you ever heard of regression to the mean? And we said, ooh, actually, that's what's going on. So what happens is when you have repeated measures over time, and of course, that's what we're doing. We're looking at changes over time in a lot of our studies. If you have sites that have happened to have had really high values to start with, they're going to come closer to the mean the next time you sample, probably. Statistically. If you had really low samples, they're probably going to come up a little bit higher. So the dotted line is actually the null hypothesis, and the solid line is the actual data. So you have to be real careful sometimes in what your null hypothesis is when you're dealing with these long time scale repeated measures. So I found that really interesting. And then time scale, other things, Dan Richter, I think, has written about this, and all of you guys are aware. We have to deal with funding cycles. We have to deal with people moving and changing and not maybe giving their data over. Loss of data in archives. I've gone through the pains of trying to put together data from a 45-year study. And sometimes people don't put units on their measurement sheets. That's really disappointing. And we have member company changes. And then we have sort of the death and dismemberment of research sites. And we've talked about how it'd be interesting to have a paper about sort of the mortality of experiments over time as things change. So if any of you have wise words of wisdom as to how to navigate some of these things, I'm all ears. So moving forward into the future, I think in terms of talking about scale, in ag, they're talking more about these hub and spoke models, which is actually kind of what we're sort of doing already in terms of having an intensively managed site and then extrapolating that out to other research sites. You think about the N15 work, that's within another research objective, and so hopefully we can scale up what we're learning in some of these smaller intensive sites to our larger landscape scale sites. And in ag, they've kind of ignored this for a while because everybody sort of said, well, my area is different than your area, so I'm not going to look at what you're doing. I'm just going to, you know, focus on just Southern Illinois. And so meta-analysis is becoming a bigger thing now so that we can try to put some of this data together and actually look across the landscape as what different people are seeing. Problem with that is a lot of people don't actually report the things that you need to do a meta-analysis. So I did my first and hopefully last meta-analysis on enhanced efficiency fertilizers, and it was a nightmare. And so I got interviewed for a little special they were doing with CSA News, and this is kind of a funny aside, but so I was the new guy, you know, while the other people had done several meta-analyses, and so I talked to this lady for like an hour, and I was talking about how it was pretty difficult when you got started, and at some point I must have said, you know, oh, when we started looking at this, we were all like, whoa, this is really hard. And of course, that's the quote that she took for the article. I was like, really? Like, this is my first, like, interview, and you're going to take the quote, whoa, this is really hard? I'm sure I said more, you know, brainy things in the process, and you had to pick that one. So you don't be careful what you say when it's being recorded. So thinking about the future, and you know, for our generation, thinking about what can we do to be thinking about mitigating climate change, and we know that things are going to change. So what sort of experiments can we put in now to look at how management might help mitigate certain issues with climate change? I think that's one of the things we really need to be thinking about a lot. So to sum it all up, and I think I'm doing pretty good on time, as early career scientists, we get stretched in a lot of directions trying to do a lot of things, and you feel pretty thin sometimes in terms of how much energy you have left to, you know, to do anything at all. But I think just, I try to sort of think about what are the goals that we have in general, and I think it's just, we want to build a program, or I at least want to build a program that's pertinent and interesting and answers good questions, right? And then how do we balance all these scales, time scales and spatial scales, to try to really represent real soils for real people and try to solve real problems? And how do we build the foundation for the next generation coming up through the ranks? So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I have to give a great thanks to all the people that have built such a tremendous foundation for us to work on. C-Trees, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, fertilizer by irrigation study, is getting ready to get harvested, so I had a chance to get out there. This was actually the first forest plantation I ever went to, and I remember thinking, wow, it's really orderly out here. This is really neat. So it's kind of cool that I got to go out there for the last time. So with that, I thank you, and I appreciate your attention, and I'll leave it there. We went right there. Okay. So the question was sort of with the changing political climate, how do I see our roles as educators and maybe researchers changing over time? It's a very worrisome time, I think, in terms of sort of how scientists are treated and just sort of in general. I think, you know, the best we can do is continue to do what we've always been doing, which is do good science, represent ourselves well. I think, you know, to me, that's where the co-op and the partnership with industry has a really strong leg to stand on. you know, the more we can support each other as much as possible in these sort of situations, you know, I think that's the best we can do, and hold your breath for 4 years. Yeah. So much, yeah. No, that's a great comment. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, it's actually much easier than you think to build a website, I'll tell you that. It took me about an afternoon to put one together, and then my friend who's actually good at this stuff made it look pretty. So I think if nothing else, it is a really good idea to have a website. And Bill Rohn last night, I think, made a good comment to where he said, you know, people hate his website because it's ugly, but all his stuff is there. So that way, and that's kind of a legacy thing in terms of, to me, making all of your knowledge and your pictures and your data sets available, you know, that's the greatest legacy that you can give, is like publish your data sets or make them available somehow, so that when somebody comes 40 years later and wants to look at what you've done, they're not trying to like draw a line on a graph and try to figure out what your mean was, and then was that standard error of this or was that of that, and you know, so the more you can make some of that stuff available, that really facilitates our ability to look, you know, to use, you know, the legacy that's already there to its best potential. So that's what I would say. That's a great question. Okay, so what can we do? What can S7 or Forest Soils do to encourage better community, I guess, right? Food is probably the biggest one. Reception with tasty snacks and beverages, and just a chance to mix and mingle more. That's what I always appreciated about this community when I came as a grad student, was how friendly everybody was, you know, and that's one thing that sort of drew me to this community, was everybody was, you know, pretty, I don't know, everybody gets along, but people are very cordial, and it's a friendly, so I think doing what you're doing, but more snacks. Now, a friend of mine that works in the federal government, she said the great thing about the federal bureaucracy is that it's very slow to change, which can be to your advantage. So, yeah, I would agree. And I think, you know, like we said before, as long as we keep doing the good work that we're doing, you know, we'll keep moving things forward.